So how many of you love the book of Esther? Anyone? Anyone have it as their favorite book in the Bible? Oh, man. It's a rough day. I just offer my apologies ahead of time to you. Because we only budgeted 1 week for Esther anyway, and that's kind of a little bummer for some of you. There's whole Bible studies that dig into all of it. And then as I was doing my study this week, there was this cute little rabbit, and he was going down this trail. Has that ever happened to you? You're like, oh, I should follow that little rabbit. And I followed the rabbit, and then I just liked where the rabbit led me. And so we're just going to follow that little rabbit trail today. And so I just apologize if you super love Esther, and that was your great dream to hear some message on that. We'll actually come back to it at the end and kind of tie it in there. But we're going to try to find this little rabbit today. So to get there first, though, we have to answer what will seem at first like a trivia question, but I think it has more significance than that. So there's two books in the Bible, Esther and Song of Songs, that do not mention what? Jesus, God, Trinity, any of those things, right? Yeah, so a fascinating trivia question, but I think actually much more so than that, right? I mean, it's not a tremendously large book, and there's only 66, you know, smaller books that fit inside there. And for believers in God to say that two of the books that fit into that mix are ones that never even mention God, that's a little surprising, right? I mean, if you're trying to have a book that's going to lead people to God, you think you would mention God frequently, often, wherever you had an opportunity. And certainly the part we just had read, that Brad read for us from Esther, there's tremendous chances, right? Well, hey, if God doesn't save through you, he'll save through someone else. But they don't say that, right? They just say deliverance will come from somewhere. They talk about fasting, but they never quite get to praying or who they're fasting to or talking about. Like, it's just, it borders on the edge and then it backs away again. And to have these whole books to go through these scenarios, especially Esther, that never mention God, there's something there, right? Because the author had every opportunity to draw attention to God, had every chance to do that. And yet instead chose to write a book that didn't mention God at all. And not only that, but the other believers said that book is significant enough, we want it in our Bible forever for you to nourish and feed off of, even though it doesn't mention God. And so as there's this sense of this hiddenness, right? That God is not overt, that he's not easy to find. He might be there behind the scenes, but not there up front where everybody can kind of touch him and put their hands on him. I will submit to you that there is an authenticity and a humanness to this experience that is profound. And that's what I love about the Bible. It does not pretend to be this abstract theological book. It's as human as anyone you're ever going to find. Because my guess would be that there are days in your life that you go all day and you never think about God. You go all day and you never mention his name whatsoever. And so I think Esther and Song of Songs are a great reminder that we often spend a lot of our time without a conscious awareness of the presence or the reality of God, right? He is a behind-the-scenes kind of guy for a lot of our lives. And so I think these books kind of call that out, that the very natural experience that even when I look for him, sometimes I can't find him, and sometimes I don't look for him at all, right? We don't always pay attention to that. Isaiah 45 puts it this way. I'll invite you to actually read it with me. So we'll put that up there and we can all read it together. Truly, you are a God who hides himself, O God and Savior of Israel. This idea, theologically, of this hidden God, this obscured God, this difficult to find, absent God, is a really, really common one, and one that not only exists in theological books, but in our own lives too, right? For example, we have the church that lives in this world as the representative of God. And yet that church is consistently weak, is consistently divided, is consistently sinful. What's up with that? You think if God were there, it'd be like powerful and vibrant and overflowing all the time. But it's not. Right? We live in a world in which babies die, in which the wicked prosper, which spouses cheat, in which people starve. Like over and over again, there's plenty of chances for God to step in and be a lot less hidden than he is. And yet we find pretty regularly there's moments where we're like, why aren't you there? Why aren't you more obvious if you are there? Why are you so hidden all of the time? Can you take a moment and identify at least some place in the world that God seems hidden to you? Not saying he's not there, but I don't see any obvious signs, right? And then can you just share that with somebody sitting next to you? Like, here's somewhere in the world, I just wish God were more obvious, more clear, whatever. He just seems hidden in this moment or experience. Can you do that for me? Sometimes I ask more fun questions. And then it kind of bubbles over with all that energy. This was a very muted kind of discussion. A lot of people are like, I don't want to go there. But I understand that it's a difficult place to go. I just want you to understand that this is our experience, and we live in this place. And there are many things around us that cause us to say, God, why are you not more obvious and powerful and clear in these places? I want to take it one more step farther, though, because God is not about stuff that is external, but mostly about our hearts. And I will pretty much guarantee that if you've walked long in this world, right, and you're here today probably because you've sought God, or you're here because some father invited you to be here, but we'll at least assume that most of us have at least at some point in our life sought after God. And if you have, then there are moments in your own life where you have found God to be hidden. And you've prayed and heard nothing. And you've sought after him and found just a void or an absence there. So can you just make that really personal? And just for your own self, you don't have to share with anyone else around you. Say, where am I maybe the most wounded, the most hurt, the most confused by the absence of God, by the hiddenness of God? Where do I wish he would just make it clear, would just common power, would do something? It's probably a pretty raw place, but at least just to touch on that for yourself. Truly, you are a God who hides himself. Those words of Isaiah are pretty profound, and they do resonate in all of our own lives too. But let's look a little bit at that context for Isaiah, because that's always important, right? You can take a verse out of almost anywhere and make it say whatever you want it to say. So what is this hiddenness that Isaiah specifically is speaking about? If you look back at the rest of chapter 45, and even back into chapter 44, you have this scenario where Isaiah is seeing these visions of the future, where God is going to destroy and wipe away everything the Israelites had, which we have found fulfilled. And then he's describing in these chapters, though, this great redemptive movement of God, where God is going to come and restore to them their city and their families and their lives and all these kinds of things. So a beautiful description of that. Where this hidden thing comes from Isaiah, though, isn't because he doesn't see God. He's seeing God really clearly. He's talking to God. God's given him a vision. It's not that he can't find God. He says, God, you are so hidden because I'm finding you somewhere I did not expect to find you. Because the great surprise that comes in chapter 44 and 45 is God says, I'm going to do all of this redemptive work through this pagan foreigner named Cyrus. And your temple is going to be rebuilt, and your walls are going to be rebuilt, which we'll read about in the next weeks to come, and kind of all the way through July, we're going to dig into those things. And all that's going to happen not because of some great Jew somewhere, not because of anything that happens among your people, but this foreign guy who doesn't even recognize my name. And it's Isaiah hearing all of that come together. You are going to be restored, but I'm going to choose some non-Jew who doesn't even know who I am really to accomplish all of this. It's in that moment that Isaiah says, you are so hidden. I would never imagine that you would be involved in that. I would never look for you, you know, among the workings of pagan kings around the world, right? I mean, chances are if you're looking for God somewhere, you're going to open a devotion. You're going to pray, as Paul talked about. You're going to look at listen to worship music or open the Bible, something like that, right? You're not going to go and study the workings of you know, the leaders of foreign countries around the world, right? That's not where we looked at that. So he's totally surprised by that. And it adds this little nuance to us about hiddenness, right? We have this sense, and it's pretty clear, that God is not as clear and obvious as we wish that he was. But being hidden can mean a couple different things, and I want to make that really clear, because this is why I feel that this rabbit trail is worth following. Right, so one aspect or one definition of hiddenness is what you see in that picture. There's some hunter kind of squirreled away in there, and if you look closely enough, you can see the vague outline. You kind of know where they are, but you can't really pick out the details of it, right? So the idea there, whether you're a hunter or you're special ops or something like that, is I want to not be found. Right, all of your skill, all of your discipline, the clothes that you pick, everything else around you, the way that you settle yourself in there and put things on top of you, everything is designed for one purpose, to be unfound. Right? I want to get in there and I want to leave again without anybody knowing that I was there. That is the whole purpose. And there are individuals that would say this is the nature of God in our world. Right? We have a whole approach to God which is known as agnostics or agnosticism, which really encompasses that. They say, I know there's something out there, but it's unfindable, it's unknowable, undefinable. And so I just kind of give up. I know there's probably a lot of things hiding in that picture, but I can't figure them all out, right? And so maybe there's a sense that God, well, certainly he's in the world, we understand that, but really figuring him out or understanding all that is beyond our ability, right? Just absolutely hidden from us. The mind of God is bigger, the work of God is bigger, could never figure all those things out. And then there's another understanding of hiddenness that Paul mentioned a little bit in the children's message that we all have identified and experienced, right? Every single one of us, as red-blooded Americans or whatever we are, you know, has played hide-and-go-seek, right? I think you make it through life without playing that at some level. You know, kids get together, they don't know each other, play the game. You don't have to have any skill beyond the ability to count to a small number and shove yourself in a small space somewhere. You're good to go, right? Don't have to know anything else about people. You can play that. But the nature of that is different than the nature of some special ops guy hiding in the forest somewhere, right? Because here, even though you kind of don't want to be found early on, maybe you want to be found last, but you still want to be, right? Because hiding under the kitchen sink for 4 hours, not really fun anymore, right? Like, your glory days are long gone. Everyone else has gone off to do something else, right? That's missed the point of the game. The point might be it's hard to find me, right? It's difficult and a challenge, as Paul talked about. It grows over time, and wow, I finally, oh, what a creative place to hide. But the goal eventually is to be found. That's what makes it enjoyable for everybody in the process, you know? And so then we have this other model that says that sometimes there's almost this playful hiding. It says, I'm building this relationship, I'm engaging with you, I'm leaving little subtle hints and clues so that eventually you can find where I am. But the end goal is not to be unfound, but to be discovered and to be known. So as we look biblically at this struggle we have with a God who's not as obvious as we wish, we have the question, is there a God who wants to be found or a God who wants to be unfound? Is there a God who says, I don't really want a relationship, you can't grab all the things that I have, I just want to stay hidden from you, or one who desires to be discovered? I want to give you a couple stories before we find our way back to Esther and kind of discover that in there too. The first is in Exodus chapter 33. A little bit of framework for that story. It's a story of Moses and God. So we're marching our way up the first side of that, or the first mountain over there. The Israelites have left slavery. They're now at Mount Sinai. The chapter before, Moses was grabbing the Ten Commandments, came down, found they'd build this false god, this golden calf, right? And so he gets angry, upset. Everything's kind of falling apart. God's done with the people. He says, I'm leaving. I'll bless you, but I'm just done being around them. And Moses comes back a couple verses before we pick up in chapter 33 and says, God, I don't want you to go, right? I don't want to go anywhere without you. I want you to be involved in my life. And God is really blessed by that choice because he said, I'll bless you, but I just won't go with you. And Moses purposely chose and said, I'd rather have you than blessing any day. And so what we see in the middle of this big scale thing is a very intimate encounter between Moses and God. And so in verse 17, God comes back to Moses and says, well, then I'll do what you've asked, and I'll go with you, but why? And what God says to Moses is, because I'm pleased with you and because I know you by name. A very, very intimate relationship, right? I mean, for God to say, I'll do it because you're my friend. Because I just know you so well. Right? I mean, that's a really, really cool expression for God to say. And Moses is kind of understanding the intimacy of that moment. And he comes out in verse 18 with this request that honestly we've all made. It's a prayer we've all had numerous times before. So Moses, sensing that closeness to God, this throws out this bold request. And he says, hey, could I see your glory? Could I see you? Right? I mean, we've got the Ten Commandments, and I talked to you up in the mountain in the storm, and you've been involved in all these things. I've seen miracles more than any other human being to that date had ever seen before. Like, I got all of that. That's all been really good, but I haven't seen you. And I just want to see you, God. Right? I mean, that's in all our hearts, too. I just want you to be more obvious. I want you to be quite so hidden. Can you just show up? And God says, I have great glory, great wonder, great power, great goodness. But if I were to show it to you, it would overwhelm you. I can't show you that. So maybe a reason for the hiddenness, although that's not our purpose today. But then God doesn't just stay in the special ops area. Right? He finds his own loophole to his own rule that says, you can't see it. End of the story, right? But he generates his own loophole and says, well, hey, I'm going to shove you in a corner of the rock, and you can't see my glory. It would overwhelm you. It would destroy you. But once I'm past, I want you to pull your head out really quick and see the back. Just the merest reflection, the very end of what that is. So is that a picture of a God who says, I want to stay hidden forever, or of a God who just leaves little hints? He says, I'd like to be found by you. It may take a while, maybe a big, long journey in your life, but I don't want to remain hidden forever, right? Just like the kid under that blanket, right? Are they trying to hide forever? Not really, right? Part of their joy is to say, I'd like to be found. Don't take too long because it's really hot under these covers, right? I mean, just find me as soon as you can and move on with that. And so we see in that interaction with God and Moses in Exodus that there's this God who says, I want to be discovered. I want you to seek, and I want to give you these hints about who I am. Fast forward in the Bible to the book of John, right? And pick up the same kind of hints that we see. John chapter 1 begins with these great expressions of kind of the nature of God and who he is. In chapter 1, verse 18, John writes this. The same thing we already know, right? No one has ever seen God. Anyone in here prove that wrong? No. Right? Doesn't matter whether you're a pastor or new to faith or never, whatever. Like, we haven't seen God. That answer holds true for 2,000 years since John wrote it, right? No one has ever seen God. So we're back in that hidden state. God is unknowable, unsearchable, can't find him, can't discern him, all of those kinds of things. This hidden nature of God. But then John goes on to write, but... Oh, that's a good word in the Bible. But God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, what? Has made him known. So here's the reality that no one's ever seen God, right? Nobody ever has. And yet there's that flip side that God says, but I'm not totally satisfied with that. I know I made the world that way. I know I'm really hidden to you most of the time. But I want to be known. And what is the hint that's dropped there in John? Who is it that makes God known? It's Jesus, right? Entering into our world, and I know it's a total bummer, I get it, that he's not around today to see and hear and talk to and touch. That would be awesome. But there at least is still a God who broke into that world and said, I know I'm really hard to see, but I'm not totally unfindable. But here's the challenge. It's the same one that Isaiah ran into. It's not that God isn't anywhere. It's that God isn't in the places I assume he will be. Right? I look for God in a church. I look for God in formal settings. I look for God in pure kind of places. Where does Jesus show up half the time? Like in a brothel somewhere, hanging out with the prostitutes or hanging out with the most greedy people around or with people that are getting drunk, right? He is regularly castigated for that. Like, why would you be here? Right? No one would ever look for God at a rockin' party. But that's where Jesus shows up. And that surprise again. So we have these two grounding stories as Christians that over and over every year is centered back on those things again. What are they? Come on, I'm not going on if you don't tell me. What are they? Christmas and Easter, right? And they are this reminder again that God shows up. He does, but in the most surprising places. Because nobody ever looks for God in the form of a baby in some stable among animals in a smallest country in the world, in the smallest city in that country, in some little back corner even within that city, right? You can't get more humble than that. You don't look for God there, but maybe we should. Because that's where he tends to be a little bit more obvious. When you get to the whole Easter message, right? The whole surprise there is you would never look for a God who's bleeding. You don't look for a God who's suffering. You don't look for a God who's getting beat up. You don't look for a God who's failing, who's losing, who's dying. But there again are the little hints that God gives. It says, I'm not unfindable, but if you want to find me, you may have to look in different places than you assume you would have to look. And so the church, when it hits its sweet spot, does that well. Because we learn to look for God. Why is it that we engage with those who are small and weak and frail and have nothing to offer, right? Wouldn't it be better if we just focused on the wealthy and the rich? But we have this understanding that if we are to truly see Jesus, we had better place ourselves around those who are at the short end of the stick. And so we do invest in the homeless. And we do spend time with the wounded foster kids that are in our community. And we send people to Mexico, not to resorts, but to the very poorest that they have. And we have Stephen ministers that come alongside those just in messed up, grief-stricken, overwhelmed moments of life. Because we know that if we are to see this hidden God, those are the best chances we have to see him. Not when everything is going well and perfect, but when there's humility, when there's brokenness, when there's frailty. That's what we learn if we listen to the story of Scripture. Isn't that God is unfindable, but you just find him in a lot of different places. The places you don't imagine you would ever find God. And so when we move back into that story of Esther and we pick it up where it is, right? So she has this past history as a people, right, where the Jews lost their land. They lost their city, absolutely destroyed. They've been scattered among all of the other people groups and just hoping to make it, right? You just want to live another day. And then this glorious thing happens. She's kind of plucked out of nowhere and becomes the queen of the largest kingdom in the world, right? So this is an incredible story. And she's like, just hold my breath. Hope this maintains. Like, this is great. This is amazing. And then in the middle of that, this whole story unfolds about this design to destroy all of the Jews, to annihilate them. Right? That is the hiddenness of God. We've already lost our city, our land, all those things. We finally grab a little moment where we take a breath, and then we're about to get hammered once again. If you want definition of God, I cannot see, that's it. Right? And it's not only out there, but it's my own personal experience. Like, I live pretty well. Like, I'm the queen. Like, I have a lot of really good stuff. It's a nice, comfortable life. And I'm supposed to put that on the line too? God hidden yet one more time. But what Esther does for us in the midst of not telling us that God is there, in the midst of not saying that he's easy to find and easy to just pull back the curtain and there he is, right? She doesn't do that by purpose, with intent. What she does do is say that when God is hidden, this is how you live. Which is good for us, right? We have a coaster over there that says we all want to follow Jesus. And the first step to following Jesus is what? It's in the green. First two words. See Jesus. Like, it's super easy, right? All you have to do is see Jesus and then go after him. And sometimes it isn't all that hard. But what we hear from Esther today is this reality that sometimes we get stuck in that first level, and that seeing Jesus is sometimes really difficult. There's just this validation that I want you to hear. If you're in a place where there's just this absence of God, or he's very, very hidden for you, you're not wrong. You're not lacking faith somehow. You're not a failure as a follower of God. There are some times that seeing Jesus is the hardest thing we can ever do. And so what Esther outlines for us then is that first step out of two, which is to seek, right? It's to see, but adding a K at the end, because sometimes it gets harder. And there's this encouragement that even though you don't see God written in a moment, in a verse out of that whole book, that he's still worth seeking. Even if you look around your life and you don't see any vestige of him whatsoever, he is worth seeking after. And so begin with that prayer, begin asking, begin running after him. Like, I know you're doing something. The world is falling apart. I can't sense it. I can't feel anything. You know, it's just darkness all around, whatever it might be. But if I'm going to seek after you, I'm going to follow after you on some level, right? I'm going to seek, because she does that. So what all that fasting is about. Like, I have no idea what this thing is. I don't know what God is doing. I can't imagine how this could be good. But I'm not just sitting on the couch and letting go. I know you're there somewhere. So I'm going to seek. It's a place of faith. And then there's one other thing that Esther throws into the mix, right? So in our game, we've all played from childhood, there's three verbs. God does the hiding part, at least within parentheses. Seeking, what's the other verb that we're missing? Right? And I flipped the order because Esther does. And I think it's valuable for us to see that too, because that's the process, right? You can't seek from your couch. You have to move. And so look at what Esther says. In verse 16, she says, gather together all the Jews in Susa, fast for me, right? Here's the seeking. I'm going to fast, gather everyone else around me. We're fasting. But we don't just stop there, right? When 3 days are over, does she have any clarity from God? Even a hint of what he's up to, or what she should do, or where things ought to be. No. She has nothing. Zero. Zilch. Nada. After 3 days of everyone fasting together, right? God is no less hidden at that moment. So what's the next step? I've sought. I got nothing. Do you walk away? Just sit on the couch and wait? No. Look at what she says. When this is done, I will go. I'll go to the king. Right? I'm going to make some movement. I'm going to go somewhere in my life. And that is the reality for all of us as we follow. I don't know of anybody who's ever gotten the whole game plan from God. I just outlined the whole thing. Like, here, this is all you need to know. Just follow it out, right? The way that God works in our life is gives us little hints, one little step, one little direction to go. And very often, he won't give you anything else until you take that one step. And for Esther, the only thing she had is, I need to talk to the king. I don't know what to ask. I don't know how to ask it. I don't know where to go about it. I don't know any of those other things. That's all I need to know. And God gave her nothing else until she took that step. And the same thing is true in our lives. That's that hidden nature of God. And you can rail against it all you want, but when you struggle with it, very often there is that step that we have to take that says, go. Like, do something with what God has placed in front of you. Even if you aren't sure what it is or where it is, even if you think it may be going the wrong direction, the worst thing is just to get totally frozen. Like, I can't step anywhere until I know with total clarity where God calls me to be. Very often on that coaster, like doing good with Jesus, you may not know what it's all about. You may not even know exactly what you ought to be doing, but there are times in all of our lives when God is hidden that we have to just step out and begin to do something and not always remain. And God leads in the middle of that. He is faithful to do that, but not until you take that step. And it's always risk. It's always cost. It's always fear in that. What if I'm doing the wrong thing? What if I'm going the wrong direction? What if I don't know? But he calls us to step out.